And now on WRS, Michael McKay with the McKay Interview.
Hello, everyone. I'm back in UN country today, in Geneva, the globally acknowledged home of multilateralism, sitting in the permanent mission of a country which was a founding member of the League of Nations and of the United Nations, and a country whose head of state, herself an immediately recognizable face around the world, has just celebrated the 70th anniversary of her accession to the throne, making her the longest reigning monarch in history. Of course, I'm talking about Queen Elizabeth II and the United Kingdom. And I'm the guest of the United Kingdom's permanent representative, Ambassador Simon Manley, who's been in this very busy diplomatic post for just over a year now, coming from Madrid before Geneva, where he was ambassador to Spain. He's a long-time career diplomat, having worked in New York and Brussels earlier in his career. Welcome to the McKay Interview, Ambassador Manley. Thanks for inviting me here to the UK mission this morning.
Well, thanks very much for being here.
Look, I'm really looking forward to our conversation, having had similar ones with three of your predecessors, all in the same room, in fact. So I'm learning, I hope, fairly quickly. My questions range from multilateralism to what is happening in the UK at present to some of the bigger questions concerning international relations. So let's start with multilateralism. Isn't it, multilateralism, dead? Now that a member of the United Nations and a permanent member of the UN Security Council at that, has taken upon itself to invade a sovereign neighbouring country, which it even says it doesn't recognise, and conduct unilaterally a war of aggression in plain sight of the world's media, the UN and other multilateral bodies. Isn't this a mortal blow to the credibility of multilateralism? Does it not have a direct impact on the work done in international Geneva and people like you?
Look, clearly Putin's extraordinary aggression against Ukraine is, as you say, a flouting of all the international rules. It's a flouting of the Charter. It's a flouting of international law. It's a challenge to the multilateral system. But I don't agree that multilateralism is dead. I actually think that the response of the multilateral system, particularly here in Geneva, has been really strong. Whether you look at that in the Human Rights Council or the WTO, or actually across the whole breadth of the sort of the more technical bodies here in Geneva, UN Economic Commission for Europe, International Telecommunication Union, and elsewhere, where I think we have rallied around, we have said that we stand up for international law, we stand up for the Charter, we support Ukraine and Ukraine's fundamental choice of what it wants to be as a country. And that's an absolutely fundamental aspect of the international system. And it's interesting, I think, you know, back in late February when Putin launched his invasion, we had just chosen the dates for the latest ministerial conference of the WTO. And to be honest, there were a lot of people around that time who said, look, you can't possibly hold a ministerial conference of the WTO during wartime. It's going to be a disaster. Russia's going to kind of dominate it all. And yet, just a couple of weeks ago, we held a ministerial conference of the WTO, which probably agreed the widest range of ministerial outcomes that we've seen from a WTO ministerial conference in a generation. So multilateralism is alive and kicking.
We're going to come on to the WTO in a moment. But just as a corollary to that, one of the criticisms nowadays, just generally, is that people's attention span seems to be shorter. You're not worried that people don't just run out of stamina, even at the UN level, and just drift off into another issue and lose interest in what's going on in Ukraine?
So, look, it's a challenge because this is going to be a protracted conflict. It's a conflict we are absolutely sure that Ukraine will win. And it will win because its cause is right, and because it has the support of the international community. But we do need to sustain the pressure. We need to sustain the diplomatic isolation of Russia, and we need to ensure that we provide all the support we can to Ukraine. And I think that was the great common conclusion out of the G7, and you've seen it again just now in Lugano, that we are with Ukraine for as long as it takes.
Ambassador, I just want to try and get behind some of the real issues in the big multilateral dossiers on your desk. And I think our listeners and me personally anyway would be very interested to hear this. What I mean to ask is, do you from time to time raise yourself above, so to speak, looking at the issues just from a UK perspective and take the broader and wider view so as to have a fuller appreciation of the issues, all the arguments and the various points of view on those matters on your desk. And let me give you a concrete example. World Trade Organization, which you've mentioned already. A big play has been made about the successes of the recent meeting here in Geneva. I think it's called the 12th Ministerial Conference, or MC12. Now, I'm not a trade specialist, obviously, and I doubt many of our listeners are either, but I did read that the important steps, and I put those in quotation marks, were taken in the areas of food security, pandemics, intellectual property rights, and fisheries subsidies. But what is the bigger picture of these important steps, Ambassador? What do we non-specialists, people just going about our day-to-day lives, need to appreciate and understand about the work being done by professionals like you and the broad benefits that accrue to us? Sorry for the long question.
No, not at all. Look, I mean, I think we are all very conscious of the fact of not getting kind of drawn into the detail and remembering why it is we're here. Why it is we're here representing the UK, standing up for the values in which we believe, standing up for multilateralism, effective multilateralism that brings effective solutions to people, not just in the UK, but globally. And, you know, in our kind of focus on Ukraine, I think it's really important that we don't lose sight of the other big issues out there on the international agenda, whether that be Afghanistan, Yemen, Horn of Africa or elsewhere. In looking at MC12... let me just kind of give you a couple of examples. And let me just start by saying how important the WTO is. And I think, you know, to those of your listeners who are out there in business, they'll know the importance of clear and resilient trade rules for us, whether we're importers or exporters or investors. And the WTO is right at the heart of that international framework of rules that govern international trade, allow international trade to flourish. And let's remember that whatever our current economic challenges, the basic thing is that globalization over the last couple of decades has enabled us to lift tens of millions of people out of poverty across the world.
Yes, that's a fact. Yeah. That's a fact. Yeah.
And if you look at this result of this last ministerial conference, MC12, outcomes across the piece, but let me just kind of highlight a couple which I think are of real relevance. Fisheries subsidies. The fact is that global fish stocks are reducing at an alarming rate. And that's worrying for fish, clearly, but it's worrying for those fishing communities across the world, many of them in some of the most vulnerable communities across the world, in small island developing states. And the reason those fish stocks are declining is because of over-subsidised fishing by particularly larger fishing nations. This fishing agreement that we secured at the ministerial conference, the first ever environmental agreement that WTO has ever made, for a start, right, which is important even of itself, gives us a platform by which we can start to try and reduce those levels of subsidies and to enable us to start trying to rebuild those fishing stocks for the benefit of fishing communities across the world. Mm-hmm. Second example I'd take out of MC12 is the agreement on what is known as the e-commerce moratorium, which is a moratorium on the imposition of taxes, duties on digital trade. May seem a bit abstract, but essentially that is of interest to anybody, any of us who is trying to download our Netflix movie, or to businesses that are trying to export. And I think, look, one of the positives, if you look and like, that's emerged out of our experience of the pandemic is the rapid digitalization of international trade of business and the opportunities that offers. Often says, you know, like take a small micro business that might be in Jamaica or in Nigeria or in the UK. And what the digitalization of business enables is that suddenly your market is no longer Kingston or Lagos or Manchester.
It's been dramatic.
It can be global.
Right. That's right.
And, you know, had we been unable to extend this e-commerce moratorium, you would have basically been kind of adding a tax burden to that process of digitalizing international trade, of opening up opportunities for entrepreneurs globally. That would have been a bad thing, but nonetheless, we have secured a further extension of that moratorium. We'd like to see it permanent.
So I was going to ask you that, because you use the word moratorium, so obviously there's something else coming down the line at a future major meeting.
Well, so this is a moratorium that's kind of been extended kind of by a couple of years each time. We've extended for another 18 months. We want to find a permanent solution to this. You know, the notion that we should be trying to kind of tax digital trade out of existence is a crazy one at a time. What we should be trying to do in the WTO and more generally is trying to enable the digitalization of global trade, break down the barriers to it, ensure we've got free flow of data, so that that business, that micro business, I say, whether it be in Kingston, Jamaica, or Kingston upon Hull, it can benefit from global trade rules to grow and prosper, to the benefit not just of that business, but to the people it employs and the consumers who depend upon its goods and services.
Good, thank you. My guest today is Ambassador Simon Manley, the UK's permanent representative to the United Nations and other international organisations in Geneva, and I'm with him in the UK mission Geneva. Ambassador, now may I turn to something quite different, the political noise that's been coming from Downing Street in London. Obviously, you're very much aware of it, for months, and even louder since yesterday. Ambassador, I can't remember the last time that two senior cabinet members resigned on the same day, and after writing such critical resignation letters to the Prime Minister and about the Prime Minister. Can you, and I won't ask you to answer that question, but all the goings on inside 10 Downing Street, the so-called Partygate scandals, the recent vote of no confidence in the Prime Minister by his backbench MPs, which he won, incidentally, the great general media hubbub and the apparent loss of public respect for the Prime Minister himself, according to the opinion polls anyway, and now these high-level resignations, aren't they all rather distracting for you, trying to conduct the international business of state and the important foreign affairs in the United Kingdom, Ambassador?
So I think the kind of, you know, it may sound odd, but actually if you went kind of walking around this mission this morning or talking to the teams, they would be absolutely single-minded in their focus of getting on and doing the job they do day in, day out for the UK.
Because they're led well by you probably, Ambassador.
Well, I'm not sure about that. I think they're really motivated to do what's right for our country, for our businesses, for our consumers, to stand up for our values. You know, so just this week, we're in the Human Rights Council. Zeva taking a really active role as one of the leading members, if not the leading member, most active member of that council. We're running resolutions on sexual violence in Syria and on human rights in Sudan. People just get on with the job. And I think they are tremendously proud to serve their queen and country.
Are you implying somehow then there is a separation somehow in your mind and the minds of your team between state and government? No, is that too fine a point?
No, I think people are obviously they're interested in what's going on politically at home. Whether of course, they're, you know, we here in this mission, we employ people of all nationalities. It's not just Brits here.
No, I appreciate that.
Many people recruited here in Switzerland. So people are obviously interested in politics. That's kind of one of the reasons they join these organisations. But I think they are motivated by the desire to serve Queen and country and to do good in the world.
Okay. Now, another question about the UK, Ambassador. This is really a question to ask you about the UK's relationship with the EU and the Northern Ireland Protocol in particular. It's the reason I ask is because it's puzzling, and I've asked this question a number of times to different ambassadors just to understand it, because, of course, it's been evolving the last 2 years. And if anybody remembers the Brexit campaign, Northern Ireland was hardly even mentioned in the campaign. Please, could you explain what's going on, especially in the light of the second reading of the bill passed just last week in the Commons concerning proposed legislation to allow the UK unilaterally to disregard previously agreed Brexit arrangements for Northern Ireland at the risk of a trade war with the EU. And as you know, the EU is widely reported as saying that this will place the UK in contravention of international law. And now just a couple of days ago, we read of the Council of Europe Commissioner for Human Rights, Mijatovic, if I pronounce his name correctly, following a five-day visit to the United Kingdom, said that legal reforms, and I quote what I've read in the press, legal reforms should not weaken human rights protections in the UK. I mean, surely this is embarrassing for the UK. What's really going on, Ambassador? Could you explain it to us?
So, the reforms that we're looking at in terms of the Human Rights Act are entirely designed to strengthen human rights in the UK, not designed to weaken them. We wouldn't engage in them otherwise. On the question of the Northern Ireland Protocol, look, the issue of Northern Ireland has been a complex issue in the negotiations for our departure from the European Union, and it's obviously been an important part of our negotiations and discussions with the European Union since then. The simple fact of the matter is that the protocol as it currently exists is not working. It is not working to protect and promote the fundamental interests here, which is to make the Good Friday or the Belfast Agreement work, to enshrine the peace and security of Northern Ireland.
Even though the government signed up to it?
The government signed up to it, but as with any agreement, you have to look at actually how it works in practice.
And no, it's I understand that.
It's not working in practice. Yeah. And so, look, we have put an enormous effort into our discussions with the European Union, discussions led by Liz Truss and indeed supported by a former ambassador here, Julian Braithwaite, now Director General for Europe in the Foreign Office. We have tried to find a way through those with our European colleagues, and we remain absolutely ready to work with them to find a solution to this. The reality is, at the moment, they're saying, you know, no solution is possible. Well, that's kind of odd, to be honest, because the protocol always envisions the possibility of there being changes to it, new agreement. That's what we're saying. Let's try and find a way through here that protects the single market, but also avoids a hard border, that protects the integrity of the United Kingdom. Right? This is a really fundamental issue for any country.
Absolutely.
Yeah?
Absolutely.
To protect your own integrity as a country and to ensure that we can maintain the progress that we have seen over the last few decades in Northern Ireland after the Troubles, of finding a way to respect the Good Friday Agreement and to build on the peace and stability in the province.
Mm. It's bound to be resolved at some point by negotiation, but I guess for most of us, particularly those from the UK, realise the heat, the tension, the sentiment, the emotion of many, many, many decades, and we just hope for a good resolution.
So do we.
I ask you a question now, which is perhaps a bit premature, Ambassador. Maybe I should put it to you next year, but it's really about the country that's our host. As you know, last month, the United Nations General Assembly elected Switzerland as a non-permanent member of the UN Security Council for 2 years, starting 1st of January next year. What difference will Switzerland's membership of the UN Security Council make to the United Kingdom, which has been a permanent member of the SC since its creation in 1945, and the usual diplomatic exchanges that you have within what is in effect your host country here? What difference will it make, Switzerland being on that?
Well, I think it's a really good thing.
Yes, I agree with you.
I was a young diplomat in New York before Switzerland became a member of the United Nations. So to move from being a non-member of the United Nations to a non-permanent member of the UN Security Council is a great achievement.
It's a big leap, yeah.
I recognise it's that journey has not always been easy for Switzerland, and the matter of some political controversy at times. But we really welcome the prospect of our Swiss allies being with us on the Security Council. Switzerland brings enormous expertise and insight to the work of the Security Council. Just look at the Lugano conference this week.
Give me some examples.
So, I mean, look at the role that Switzerland has played just this week in bringing together Ukraine and its supporters across the international community, heads of international organisations in Lugano to look at how we are going to reconstruct Ukraine after Putin's barbarous invasion. Look at the role that Switzerland has traditionally played in kind of humanitarian organisations, their role with the ICRC and others. So I think Switzerland brings tremendous diplomatic insight and experience. We really look forward to working with them. We have a very strong relationship with them here in Geneva, of course, not only as our hosts, but as partners and allies right across the piece, from the WTO, where the Swiss ambassador is chair of the General Council, the the most sort of senior meeting of ambassadors through to the UN, where we work with them very closely, particularly on kind of humanitarian issues, as through our what's called our humanitarian liaison working group. So look, this is it's a really good thing, we think, for Switzerland, for the UK, for our relationship, and for the UN Security Council and its fundamental role in maintaining international peace and security at a time when that task is more difficult than ever.
It's very encouraging to hear that because, as you know very well, and many people listening, there are many active bilateral negotiations going on at present between Switzerland and the United Kingdom. And I just wanted to hear how that affected or how you see it through the lens of multilateralism here in Geneva.
Yeah. No, look, we're delighted at the progress in our bilateral relationship with Switzerland over the last few years. And it's obviously at the heart of that is the relationship we're trying to build commercially through a new free trade agreement, but look also at the kind of the increasing ties we have in areas like science and tech, where I think the two countries have an enormous amount to offer the world, but we have an enormous amount that we can and should be doing together.
Good. Last question, Ambassador. It's a little bit long, but there's good reason for its length, so please bear with me.
But depends on what my answer is it, really?
I try to avoid ending my interviews on a negative note, but we have a war in Europe. We've already talked about that on a scale never before seen, at least in my lifetime, and I'm well past my 70 years. Over 8 million refugees, I read, have left Ukraine since the end of February, about the same number displaced within Ukraine. So that's two Switzerlands. 2 years ago, I'm coming to the point slowly, during the height of the COVID pandemic, we celebrated 75 years, the anniversary of the adoption of the UN Charter. Jaw, jaw, better than war, war, Winston Churchill's famous maxim. Become the embodiment of post-war 1945 international community's worldview concerning the desirability of dialogue over destruction in the conduct of relations between states. Human rights, 75 years ago, and now have much broader implications than those days. Now, due to events triggered by the 24th of February, illegal invasion of Ukraine, NATO seems to me, anyways, now the de facto military arm of the United Nations. My question is this. What's the difference? What's the significance of this potentially dangerous bipolar world that confronts us, given that today there are no heads of state, of important and influential states at least, alive, who have any personal recollection of the destruction of large parts of Europe and Japan when peace was declared in 1945, whereas in 1939, at the outbreak of World War II, there were at least certainly some political leaders around who remember the carnage of the Great War of 14 to 18, even fought in it, and yet World War II still happened. Ambassador, are we not at the point of a true paradigm shift in international relations? Again, sorry for the long question.
Not at all. Look, I think Putin's invasion was a wake-up call. And it's a wake-up call that perhaps some countries should have heard a little while ago when he attacked Crimea, or indeed when he attacked Georgia. Or when he tried to assassinate people on the streets of London or the streets of Salisbury in the UK. So look, we are not, we're always pretty wise, I think, to President Putin's attitude towards international law. I take some satisfaction in the strength of the international reaction to Putin's invasion. I take satisfaction from the strong stance we've seen here in Geneva, from the Human Rights Council, within the WTO and elsewhere. But I take particular satisfaction from the strong stance that we've seen from the international community over the last 10 days or so, whether that be at the G7 summit or at the NATO summit in Madrid, which I think saw a really fundamental shift in NATO's approach and an extraordinary sense of commitment, or indeed at the conference in Lugano. This is an international community that is showing itself resolute in the face of Putin's invasion. I think he miscalculated. He miscalculated the strength of Ukrainian opposition, and I think we are all in awe at the strength of Ukrainian military opposition on the ground, but also the work of our Ukrainian colleagues here in Geneva. And I think he miscalculated about the strength and unity of the West, and they clearly miscalculated about the reaction of the European Union, of the United Kingdom, of the United States, and now of NATO. And what we are now actually facing is a bigger NATO, a more united NATO, and a NATO that is even clearer about its strategic role in standing up for the security of the alliance and for our values as an alliance.
And you feel confident that this generation is having to confront this aggression and this change, if you like, of circumstance, will see a change, a paradigm shift that takes us through, let's say, the next 10, 15, 20 years?
I think we are all being inspired, aren't we? Day in, day out, by the commitment, resolve, and skill of our fellow Europeans in Ukraine as they stand up against Russian aggression, they stand in defence of their homeland and for the values of freedom and security, which are all our values. They're fighting a war for the freedom of their country, but in so doing, they're fighting for the freedom and security of Europe as a whole.
Ambassador, thanks very much for answering all my questions and being so patient with my long-winded questions and helping my understanding, and I hope that of our listeners. My guest today has been Ambassador Simon Manley, the UK's permanent representative to the United Nations and other international organisations in Geneva. Thank you, Ambassador.
It's been a real pleasure. Thank you.
That was the McKay Interview with Michael McKay. And don't forget, you can hear that interview again on our website, worldradio.ch.